You know, it is so easy to look at a blood draw and just see it as this purely mechanical task. You find the line, you connect the syringe, you pull back, and you're done.
Yeah, it seems totally straightforward when you just watch it happen.
Right. But when you actually sit down with the clinical standards, and for this deep dive, we are looking at a massive stack of source material. We have guidelines from Island Health stretching from 2013 all the way to their recent 2025 updates, plus the national standards from the Canadian Vascular Access Association.
Right, the CVAA guidelines.
Exactly. And we've also got some technical tables on complications from Cobbett. When you synthesize all of that, you realize pretty quickly that drawing blood from a central vascular access device is actually a high-stakes exercise in physics and fluid dynamics.
It really is. I mean, it is definitely not just a poke. When you are dealing with indwelling lines, so your CDAs, your PICCs, arterial lines, hemodialysis catheters, you're managing a direct conduit to the patient's central circulation. The margin for error there is incredibly slim.
Slim to none, really. It feels less like a simple procedure and more like a, well, a technical orchestration. We are talking about pressure gradients, turbulence, chemical compatibility, and these rigorous safety protocols. If you miss just one step, you aren't just risking a bad sample. You could be compromising the line or actively harming the patient.
Or getting a lab result that is technically accurate for the fluid that's in the tube, but completely wrong for the patient's actual physiology.
Which is a nightmare.
Total nightmare.
Yeah.
Because that sends the medical team down this rabbit hole of wrong treatments.
And that brings us to the mission for today's deep dive. We are stripping back the checklist to really understand the logic, the how, and the why of blood sampling from these lines. So for you listening, whether you do this every day or you're just fascinated by the mechanics of medicine, we want to look at the core tension running through all of this.
Which is the concept of the closed system.
Yes, the closed system.
Right, because the goal here is to breach a sterile closed loop to extract a sample without letting bacteria in, without causing the blood to clot and occlude the line, and this is the really big one, without pulling a sample that's diluted by the medication already running through it.
So let's start with the setup. Something that really struck me in the 2025 Island Health Standard is how they have completely tightened up the requirements for patient identification. It seems like we have moved way past the era of just glancing at a
Oh,
wristband.
we absolutely have. The 2025 update is very explicit about this. It requires three independent identifiers now, not two, three.
Wow, three.
Yeah, you need the full name, so last and first, the date of birth, and a numerical identifier like the MRN or the PHN.
And the document emphasizes that this has to be an active process. It literally says you have to verify this verbally with the patient.
Exactly. It is a verbal contract. You aren't just scanning a barcode or reading a label. You are engaging the patient to confirm they are who the paperwork claims they are. It's the best defense against those catastrophic wrong procedure errors.
Speaking of engagement, there is another significant addition to the 2025 guidelines that stood out to me. The explicit inclusion of cultural safety and humility.
Yes, that's a vital update to the protocols. The guidelines explicitly acknowledge that these procedures are happening on the traditional territories of the Coast, Salish, Nutchinoth, and Kwakwaka'wakw peoples.
It really reframes the whole concept of safety. Because we usually think of safety as, you know, sterile fields and sharps containers.
Physical safety.
Right, but this reminds us that safety is also about the environment you create for the patient. It's about ensuring they feel respected and free from discrimination during what is frankly a very vulnerable procedure.
Absolutely. Because a technically perfect blood draw in a dismissive or hostile environment is still a fundamental failure of care. The protocol is basically codifying that relational aspect of nursing and medicine.
I love that. So, okay, we have established the environment, we've ID'd the patient. Now we are standing there, staring at the IV pump. The infusion is running. And this leads us to the 5-minute rule. I feel like in a busy ICU, this is the rule that is most tempting to bend.
Oh, it's incredibly tempting when you're rushing.
Yeah.
But the physics dictate that you absolutely cannot bend it. The guideline is rigid. You must stop all infusions for a full 5 minutes before drawing blood.
And the why here is pure fluid dynamics, right? It's not just about hitting pause on the pump so the machine stops beeping.
No, it's about clearing the local vasculature.
Yay.
If you have fluids or medications running, the blood in that immediate area of the vein is completely saturated with that infusant.
It's mixed in.
Exactly. If you pause the pump and draw immediately, you aren't analyzing the patient's circulating blood volume. You're analyzing this cocktail of blood and saline or blood and whatever medication was just running.
So you could end up with a lab report saying the patient has weirdly low electrolytes, but it's really just because you drew a sample that was like 30% normal saline.
Precisely. Or you might think a drug level is toxic when it's actually therapeutic. You're making massive clinical decisions based on a contaminated sample. And this rule actually gets even stricter when we talk about total parenteral nutrition, the TPN.
The big nutrition bags.
Right. The guidelines basically say do not touch it.
Just stay away.
Yeah. The exact wording is ensure blood collection is not drawn from a TPN line. The only exception, the absolute only one, is if it is clinically indicated, because literally no other access is possible, and it's a single lumen PICC.
What is it about TPN specifically? Is it the thickness of it?
It is the lipids. Mm. The fats and the sugars in that solution are incredibly sticky. They adhere to the lumen of the catheter like grease in a drain pipe.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and even if you flush it heavily, residues can remain inside the plastic tubing.
And if those lipids get into your blood sample tube,
it turns the serum cloudy. It becomes lipemic. It ruins the chemical analysis completely, and you just get garbage data from the lab.
Okay, so the pumps are off. We have waited our 5 long minutes. Now we get into the actual extraction. And this is where the sources highlight a concept that feels kind of counterintuitive to the whole goal of medicine. Usually we want to save blood, but here we have the discard.
The necessary waste. To get a good sample, you literally have to throw blood away.
This is all about clearing the dead space in the catheter, right?
Correct. The catheter isn't just sitting there empty. It is filled with the saline or the heparin lock solution that you used previously to keep it open. If you draw that directly into your sample tube, your blood is diluted.
Makes sense.
So you have to pull out enough volume to clear that lock solution completely and get to the fresh circulating blood.
I noticed there's a bit of a discrepancy in the exact volume required depending on which standard you're reading. The CVAA, so the national body, suggests carding at least 6 millipole for adults. But the Island Health 2025 document specifies 5 millibills for things like CVADs, PICCs, and arterial lines.
Yeah, that 1 ml difference is interesting. It likely reflects a local balance between ensuring sample purity and trying to minimize iatrogenic blood loss. But then you look at hemodialysis catheters, and the discard rules just change completely.
Oh, yeah, the volume is huge for dialysis. The text says 2 to 3 times the lumen fill volume.
Because those catheters are large bore. They hold a massive amount of fluid compared to a PICC. If you don't clear them thoroughly again, 2 to 3 times that internal volume, you are guaranteed a contaminated sample.
Unless you are drawing during the actual dialysis treatment?
Right. If you draw from the arterial side of the circuit while the machine is actively running, the blood is already circulating rapidly, so no discard is needed there.
Speaking of no discard, I have to mention the VAMP system, the venous arterial blood management system. The source material highlights this as a major efficiency tool.
It is a brilliant piece of engineering, honestly. It essentially solves the waste problem.
Because it has that built-in reservoir, right?
Exactly. You pull the clearing volumes, that mixture of saline and the initial blood, up into a reservoir sitting on the line itself. You close it off, take your pure sample from the designated port, and then this is the magic part. You reinfuse that clearing volume right back into the patient.
So 0 blood is wasted. That has to be the gold standard, especially for patients getting drawn multiple times a day.
It absolutely is. It prevents that cumulative blood loss we worry so much about in long-term critical care.
Let's pivot and talk about the hardware in your hand, the syringe. I think there's a common misconception, maybe from TV or just basic intuition, that a smaller syringe is more precise or gentler on the vein.
And the guidelines are screaming absolutely not to that idea.
It's a total physics track.
It really is.
Yeah.
The guideline mandates using a 10 millimeter or larger syringe for flushing and initial access. This all comes down to PSI, pounds per square inch.
Force over area.
Precisely. A smaller barrel diameter actually concentrates the force. If you push down on a tiny 3 millimeter syringe with your thumb, you are generating significantly higher pressure at the catheter tip than you would with a 10 milliliter syringe using the exact same hand strength.
So a 3 milliliter syringe is basically acting like a high-pressure water cannon inside the patient's vein.
Yes, and it's a massive rupture risk. You can actually blow out the catheter material or damage the vessel wall just by flushing with a small syringe.
So 10 milliliter is the absolute safety floor. And while we're on the topic of flushing, the sources make it clear that the technique matters just as much as the tool, the push-pause method.
Turbulent flow. That is the goal here. You do not want a laminar smooth stream of saline just gliding through the center of the tube. You want turbulence to actually scrub the internal walls of the catheter.
So you literally push, pause, push, pause.
Right. That stop-start motion creates these little eddies inside the line that scrub away fibrin, drug precipitate, and any leftover residue.
It's the difference between gently rinsing a dinner plate under the tap and actually scrubbing it with a sponge.
That is the perfect analogy.
Let's move to the actual extraction method itself.
Wow.
We have two main contenders outlined in the documents, the syringe method and the vacutainer method. The sources seem to heavily imply that for central lines, the syringe method provides much better control.
It does. With a syringe, you have tactile feedback. You can feel the resistance of the line in your hand. If you pull back too fast, you might collapse the catheter tip against the vein wall. But with a syringe, you can modulate your pull to keep the flow smooth and steady.
Whereas a vacutainer just applies this constant hard vacuum.
Right. You have zero control over that pressure. It is all or nothing.
But if we use the syringe method, we introduce a new step that has a massive safety warning attached to it, the transfer.
This is non-negotiable in the guidelines. You have blood in the syringe. You need it in a vacuum tube. You must use a needle-free vacutainer transfer device.
I feel like we have all heard those horror stories of people popping the top off the test tube and just trying to squirt the blood in.
Or holding the tube in their bare hand and pushing a sharp needle through the rubber stopper. That is just a recipe for a needle stick injury or a massive blood splash. The transfer device locks everything together safely and allows the vacuum in the tube to pull the blood in at the exact right speed.
But even once the blood is safely in the tube, the physics aren't done. The guidelines have this very specific warning: do not shake.
Never shake the baby and never shake the blood sample.
It is memorable. But seriously, this is about preventing hemolysis, right?
Yes. Red blood cells are incredibly fragile. If you shake the tube vigorously, those cells rupture. When they break, they spill all their internal contents right into the serum. And do you know what is heavily concentrated inside a red blood cell? Potassium.
So suddenly the lab report comes back saying the patient has dangerously high potassium hyperkalemia.
Which is a cardiac emergency. The medical team might rush in to treat it with insulin and dextrose, but the patient's actual potassium is totally fine. It was just shaky hand during the draw causing a false high.
So the correct move is inversion.
Gentle inversion. You flip the tube 180 degrees and back. The guidelines usually say to do this 5 to 10 times, depending on the specific additive in the tube. You just want to gently mix the blood with the chemicals.
And the order you fill those tubes matters too. The order of draw.
Critical. You have tubes with different chemical coatings. Some promote clotting. Some prevent it with additive like EDTA or heparin.
And if you draw them in the wrong order,
you risk chemical cross-contamination. If you draw the purple top tube, which has EDTA in it, before the green top, which has heparin, you might carry over a microscopic amount of that EDTA on the needle or the transfer device.
Mm.
That contaminates the next sample and completely skews the lab results.
It really is a chemistry experiment every single time. You have to respect the reagents.
You do.
Yeah.
It's not just filling tubes. It is active chemical management.
Now, I want to pivot to the outlier in all of this. The rebel of the group. Blood cultures.
Yes, the protocol flip.
Everything we just discussed, flushing the line, discarding waste, using the existing connector, it seems like blood cultures break every single one of those rules.
They do, and for a very specific reason. When we draw a standard lab, we are analyzing blood chemistry. When we draw a blood culture, we are hunting for life. We are trying to catch bacteria.
So rule number one is no discard.
Right. If there are bacteria in the line, they might be colonizing that first few milliliters of fluid. We do not want to throw the evidence in the trash. The guidelines are absolutely explicit. Do not draw a discard prior to blood culture sample.
And rule number two is no flushing.
If possible, avoid it entirely. You want the sample to be as concentrated as possible with whatever organisms might be lurking in that line.
But the biggest operational change, and the one the 2019 CVAA guidelines are super adamant about, is the hardware itself. You cannot draw a blood culture through the existing needle-free connector.
No, you have to remove it entirely. Take it off.
Why is that step so necessary?
Think about that connector. It's a piece of plastic that has been sitting on the patient's line for days. It has threads, ridges, little nooks and crannies. Biofilm, that microscopic slime layer of bacteria, loves to grow in those spaces.
So if you draw your culture directly through that old connector,
you might pick up bacteria that are just living locally on the plastic, not actually circulating in the patient's bloodstream.
Right.
That gives you a false positive.
Which means the patient gets put on heavy-duty 5-E antibiotics, like vancomycin, for a systemic infection they do not actually have.
Exactly. It completely complicates their care for no reason, destroys their gut flora, and keeps them in the hospital longer. So the procedure is strict. Remove the old connector. Then you have to scrub the actual hub of the catheter, the hard plastic interface itself, with alcohol.
And letting it dry is the key part, right?
It is the most important part. Friction removes the bulk of the material, but the drying phase is when the alcohol actually leases the cell walls and kills the remaining bacteria. Then you draw your sample directly from that sterile hub.
And then obviously you put a brand new sterile connector on.
Brand new and primed with saline. It is a completely different workflow compared to a standard CBC draw. You literally have to switch your mindset from being a chemist to being a microbiologist.
I want to get into the scary stuff now. Segment 5 of our deep dive, complications. The sources list a few things that can go wrong, but one of them sounds like something straight out of a horror movie. Air embolism.
It is a terrifying complication.
Yeah.
Basically, it's air entering the venous system.
And the symptom listed in the table is subcutaneous emphysema. The description they use is a crinkling paper sensation.
Under this, it is all about managing pressure gradients. Air wants to rush from an area of high pressure, which is the room, to an area of low pressure, which is the central veins near the heart. So we have to reverse that gradient. We position the patient supine, flat on their back. This naturally increases their central venous pressure, and we use the Valsalva maneuver.
That's having the patient bear down, right?
Yes. Bearing down or humming continuously. It increases the intrathoracic pressure inside the chest. It pushes blood out toward the opening rather than letting air suck in, and of course, clamping. The guidelines emphasize that whenever the system is open, like when you're changing that connector for the blood culture, the catheter must be clamped.
Unless it has a specific integrated valve built in?
Correct. But if you don't have those fancy anti-reflux valves, that plastic clamp is your absolute lifeline.
The other big complication mentioned in the tables is occlusion. The line just won't draw blood. I feel like the human instinct there is to just push or pull harder, but we already established with the syringe physics that that's a terrible idea.
Very bad idea. If you meet resistance, you stop. Full stop.
One specific type of blockage mentioned is pinch-off syndrome. Just the name sounds painful.
It's a mechanical issue, not a clot. The central catheter usually passes between the clavicle, the collarbone, and the first rib. In some patients, just based on their anatomy, that space is extremely tight.
So the catheter is literally getting pinched between two bones.
Like kinking a garden hose. It is pure anatomy.
And the fix mentioned in the guideline isn't a clot-busting drug, it's just geometry.
Right. You change the patient's physical position, ask them to raise their arm on that side,
right.
Roll their shoulder back,
yeah.
Ask them to turn their head and cough.
It's wild that just saying lift your arm can fix a total medical device failure.
It opens up the anatomical space between the clavicle and the rib. If the blood flow suddenly returns perfectly when they raise their arm, you know instantly it's pinch-off syndrome.
Finally, let's talk about infection. CLABSI. Central line-associated bloodstream infection. This is the big enemy in the documents.
The enemy of all vascular access globally.
And the main defense seems to be much simpler than I expected. Scrubbing.
Scrub the hub. The guidelines are incredibly repetitive about this for a good reason. You scrub the connection point with alcohol for a minimum of 15 to 30 seconds, depending on the specific cap design.
30 seconds feels like an absolute eternity when you are standing there staring at a clock in a busy room.
It is an eternity in a busy shift. But it is the mechanical friction plus the alcohol that strips and kills the bacteria. And again, drying time. If it is wet, it is not sterile.
The source also mentions watching out for a cord-like feeling under the skin.
Yes. If you palpate the skin over the vein pathway and it feels hard, like a rope or a cord, that suggests thrombosis. A clot has formed in the veins surrounding the catheter. That's a huge red flag that the line is compromised and potentially dangerous to use.
So let's unpack this whole journey we've been on. We started with identifying the patient 3 independent times. We verified the safety of the environment with the cultural safety protocols.
We respected the physics of the line, using the right 10 milliliter syringe size to manage PSI, and discarding the dead space volume so we aren't analyzing LOX solution.
We looked at the chemistry, inverting those tubes gently to mix additives, avoiding TPN lines completely to avoid lipid contamination.
And we dealt with the biology preventing infection through rigorous scrubbing, and adapting our technique drastically when we are hunting for bacteria in blood cultures.
It really drives home the point that this isn't a passive task.
Mm.
You are not just a mechanic turning a valve. You are actively managing a life support interface every single second your hands are on that line.
Absolutely. It is a procedure that balances patient comfort, sparing them another peripheral needle stick with extreme clinical precision. When it's done right, it looks effortless. But the amount of background knowledge required to make it look effortless is just substantial.
Before we wrap up, I want to leave you listening with something that really stuck out to me in these sources. We talked a lot about the discard volume, 5 mL here, 6 mL there. In a single moment, it does not sound like much blood.
But you have to do the math over time.
Exactly. In an ICU setting, a critical patient might get blood drawn from that line every 4 to 6 hours, plus maybe an extra draw for a specific medication level or an arterial gas. That could be 30, 40, maybe 50 milliliters of blood thrown in the trash every single day just to clear the line for the real sample.
Which is the equivalent of a significant hemorrhage over the course of a week or two. It leads directly to what we call iatrogenic anemia. Anemia explicitly caused by our medical treatments and monitoring.
It raises a really provocative question for the future of vascular access. In our relentless quest for accurate lab data for that perfect undiluted sample, are we actually draining the patient of the very vitality we are trying to measure and protect?
It is a massive conflict between efficiency and conservation. Technologies like the VMAP system try to solve it, but they aren't standard everywhere yet.
It is definitely something for you to think about next time you pull back on that syringe and watch that discard volume fill up. Are we being as efficient as we are precise?
It is always a necessary question to ask yourself at the bedside.
Well, that is all the time we have for this deep dive. Hopefully, you will never look at a simple blood tube the same way again. Thanks for listening.
Stay safe out there.